The following programming is sponsored by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Hello and welcome to Positively Pro-Life Podcast. Positively Pro-Life is brought to you by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation and aims to bring you inspirational stories and conversation, important legislative updates, and informative interviews as we seek to restore and strengthen a culture of life. I'm your host, Remel Tenney, Education Director at the Federation, and as always, a warm welcome to my co-host, Acting Executive Director, Maria Gallego.
Thank you so much, Remel. It's great to be with you today.
Well, it's great to be with you as well. Now, there is a lot of activity this morning at the Supreme Court with the hearing of another abortion law related case that has garnered national attention. That is the Moyle versus United States. Now, the Biden administration has sued the state of Idaho, a state that has enacted strong pro-life laws that guarantees the most protections for unborn babies. But now they've been dragged into a test case that demands abortions be done in emergency rooms, conflicting with the state's law, as well as the federal law that gave the states the right to decide for themselves. Now, more on this. Maria has more on today's hearing. Maria is here with her update, and so let's hear from her before we go into our guest interview.
Thank you so much, Remel. The following is from a National Right to Life news release. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Moyle versus United States, consolidated with Idaho versus United States, concerning the Biden administration's attempt to mandate abortion on demand throughout all 50 states in hospital emergency rooms. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, also known as EMTALA, was enacted in 1986 and contains a duty to both a pregnant woman and her unborn child. The act never mentions abortion. The Biden administration is attempting to twist the compassionate EMTALA law to push their radical agenda of unlimited abortion, said Carol Tobias, president of National Right to Life. National Right to Life filed a friend of the court brief supporting Idaho's pro-life law, the Defense of Life Act. National Right to Life's brief argues that Biden's attempt to force hospital emergency rooms to perform abortions under the EMTALA is contrary to that federal law, which was only meant to protect emergency room patients from being dumped and does not mandate that the hospital provide medical care that is contrary to state law. Apparently, Joe Biden and his administration have determined that emergency rooms are no longer capable of providing care for both mother and child, said Tobias. The Biden administration's solution is to turn hospital emergency rooms into abortion facilities. And we'll find out later this year what the Supreme Court has to say about this case. Remel.
Well, thank you, Maria, for that update. I think it is mind-boggling that with everything that's going on, our government is so focused on enacting abortion laws in states that have already decided for themselves. So yes, it remains to be seen. And we hope that the state would uphold what it did earlier and allow Idaho to continue protecting and saving lives, especially that of the unborn. Now, with that being said, our guest today is Eric Scheidler, Executive Director of the Pro-Life Action League, which was founded in 1980 by his late father, veteran pro-life leader Joe Scheidler. This group the league recruits, equips, and trains pro-life Americans to put their convictions into action at the grassroots level through peaceful, direct action. From the league's headquarters, city of Chicago, Eric coordinates nationwide pro-life protests, rallies, and prayer vigils, such as the National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children and many other events. We'll hear more about the Pro-Life Action League from Eric himself. So welcome to Positively Pro-Life, Eric.
Great to be with you.
It's good to have you as well. Now, you have a bit of a legacy. that your father has left you. So could you tell us a little bit about the history of Pro-Life Action League and what you do now?
Sure. Well, let's go back to September 30th, 1972. My father was hunkering down to watch a Notre Dame football game. I think it was either Ohio State. Oh, I'm sorry, either Michigan State or it was Purdue. I'm not sure what the opposing team was. He went to Notre Dame. He wanted to watch the football game. But my mother, Ann, said, Joe, you can't watch the game. We have to go down to the Civic Center for a Right to Life rally. That's what everyone called it back then. It was the Right to Life issue more than the pro-life issue. So my parents took me and my two younger brothers at the time. Eventually there'd be seven of us, but there were just three Shidler kids then. I was six, and we went down to the Civic Center, which is now known as Daly Plaza. People may remember seeing the big Picasso statue there in front of the Daly Center there, which is now the Richard J. Daly Center. It's kind of an iconic Chicago scene. And somebody handed my dad a flyer, which depicted a day's work at a late-term abortion facility up in Canada where abortion had been legalized several years before. Again, this is 1972. This is before Roe v. Wade, when battles were going on in the individual states, like they are now again, over this abortion issue. And Illinois was a pretty pro-life state back then. So somebody handed him a flyer, and in that garbage dumpster depicted on this flyer, this black and white photo, there was the corpse of an aborted baby that reminded my dad. It sort of brought to mind my baby picture for him. And at that moment, abortion went from just sort of an unspeakable horror you never even think about to a passion of his. He couldn't believe that states were considering legalizing this. He didn't even know about the Roe v. Wade case that had been in the Supreme Court for about 2 years by that time, almost 2 years. And then when Roe v. Wade was handed down a few months later, he knew it was a call. With help from his boss at the ad company he was working at the time, who saw that he had become really fixated on this topic, said, Joe, you're a great PR guy. Why don't you focus on this issue? We'll keep you on the company health insurance. My mom was pregnant with my baby sister at the time. And that's kind of how it all got started. He and my mother started a small, like the Chicago Office for Abortion Information or something like that, placing ads in the paper to try to help women. And eventually he became executive director of Illinois Right to Life. And then finally in 1980, he founded the Pro-Life Action League because his heart was really in the area of activism, wanting to get regular people busy and working on the abortion issue. He was inspired in that by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. My father had chaperoned a trip to march with Dr. King in Selma, Alabama. My mother actually organized the trip. They were dating at the time. He was a teacher there, and he chaperoned a group that went down there. My mom wasn't able to go. She had exams or something, but she organized it. And that was their first foray into activism. But he saw the value of regular Americans getting involved in the issue. People coming down from the north to protest civil rights, you know, for civil rights in the South. And he wanted to see a similar kind of energy be brought to the pro-life movement. So he founded the Pro-Life Action League. And so the sort of backdrop to my childhood involved, you know, pickets, protests, leafleting neighborhoods, you know, stuffing envelopes. I recently found a picture of a protest at NBC's headquarters in Chicago over a pro-abortion episode of, I think it was the TV show Cagney and Lacey. A couple of women police officers were depicted in that TV show. And there was an abortion story in one of those episodes. And I'm there in my, you know, my varsity jacket protesting NBC in Chicago way back then. So that I kind of grew up with all of that. Then in 2002, I came to work for my dad. I had been involved in a sort of parallel ministry, an organization called the Gift Foundation that was focused on issues of marriage and family and parenting and such like. He asked me to come work for him as communications director. So I came on board with the Pro-Life Action League in 2002, almost 22 years ago. And then in 2009, I became executive director after cutting my teeth on a couple of big cases. In particular, when Planned Parenthood opened a gigantic abortion facility here in Aurora, Illinois, where my office is now. And I spearheaded what became an international controversy. You know, we had, I remember doing an interview with a newspaper from Sweden at one point about that fight. We were able to keep them closed for a while. They finally opened, but we continue to maintain a good, strong pro-life presence out there, and we're saving children's lives there. So we focus on direct action, on helping people to be effective advocates for the unborn child in their own communities through cyber counseling, prayer, vigils, protests, and protesting Planned Parenthood fundraisers and such like. We also coordinate nationwide events. We have something called the National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children that takes place the second Saturday of September every year. We have Christmas caroling at abortion facilities. There's the hashtag Protest PP protests that were inspired by the David DeLeiden Center for Medical Progress videos showing Planned Parenthood scheming to profit off of the sales of body parts from aborted babies. And so we, coordinate Planned Parenthood protests under that mantle of hashtag Protest PP. Also, reach out to the media and try to present the pro-life cause in a reasonable, rational, thoughtful way to an American populace that needs to relearn its pro-life roots.
That's just remarkable, and your family is just legendary in the pro-life movement, obviously. What are some time-tested ways of advancing the pro-life cause, do you think?
Well, one of the advantages to my experience is that I've been around the abortion issue for a very, very long time, starting in grade school. I remember in high school, my freshman year, almost every morning I used to debate about abortion with a fellow student named Catherine. Catherine Weiss and I would argue about abortion. I remember one day my friend Ruben said, "Hey, let me take up the argument today." He wanted to present the pro-life position. So, it was sort of a backdrop of my life. I remember the day my friend Bill with two L's, that was the nickname we had for him. You know how college kids are. Bill with two L's came into my dorm room at the Newman Center at University of Illinois to say, "Hey, Eric, it was a couple months ago, but remember that conversation we had in the car going to the ski slopes about abortion? I think you kind of convinced me." So I learned from all that experience the limits of argument. I learned the value of patience. I learned that you can't expect people to immediately change their minds. A very wise former Planned Parenthood staffer named Linda Curry, who spoke to one of our groups of cyber counselors once, gave us the advice that we need to let people change their minds in private. You see a lot of material out there about instant conversions, and it's impressive to see somebody who encounters a pro-life display. Maybe they see an abortion picture and it gets them thinking, it changes their mind. But we know from psychology, and we know from just experience, that when people's minds are quickly changed in a public way, they can also quickly change back. My wife, April, tells the story of watching the movie Silent Scream with Dr. Bernard Nathanson way back in high school and coming home pro-life that day from school. At a public high school. Her mother, who was pro-choice, was able to very quickly, no, there's more to the story than that. You don't realize there's this person, that person, and so on. She turned her around, and she stayed pro-choice until she met me, and we started dating, and I started talking with her at greater length about these issues. So my first answer would be patience. Whether you're talking about a one-on-one conversation that you need to give time to breathe, you need to give a person a chance to take in what you've said and maybe come back later with more questions, or whether you're talking about a very long-term and difficult project like the overturning of Roe versus Wade that took nearly 50 years to pull off. Having patience and realizing that time is an ingredient, for us, the time that a person needs to ponder their position on abortion, the time that you need to figure out what's the best next thing to say to this person, the time to learn who that person is, establishing a relationship with them. These are all crucial things. Time is our friend. We're impatient. We want to convert somebody to the pro-life cause immediately. But if we recognize that we need time to do that, that can take off some of the pressure and allow us to be a little more focused in how we're presenting our message.
Oh, that's beautiful. I mean, truth has a way of sticking. I mean, it might agitate, it might make us uncomfortable, but I think, like you said, given time, it also allows people to see it in its fullness. And that was beautiful. Now, what do you think the pro-life movement is doing really well currently?
Well, I think I would just say existing right now. The fact that the pro-life movement still exists and still has a footprint is a testament. I mean, if you look around the rest of the world, there are very few countries that where the abortion issue even appears as a cultural, social, or political issue. You know, in most of Europe, it's kind of a non-issue. I mean, the French did just enshrine it in their constitution, which is horrific. You know, you can't imagine that happening in the United States in our national constitution. That just wouldn't happen because there's a movement here that's vibrant. You know, what we're doing right is staying alive in the face of tremendous opposition and in the face of a Western world in which most countries don't have this type of a robust pro-life movement. I want to give the pro-life movement credit for, at least in part, being willing to stand back and reflect and think about this moment. I've seen a change over the last 2 years. It's not all pervasive. So in a few corners of the pro-life movement, people are starting to talk about some of the policy concerns that as pro-life people we should have. Because we recognize that, you know, most women who get abortions don't really want abortions. There's research backing this up. Charlotte Lozier Institute has put out research published in the journal Curious, peer-reviewed research, showing that only about a third of women reflecting on their abortions in their 40s will say that it was a totally free choice that they're happy with. Two-thirds of women will say that it wasn't in line with their values, it wasn't in line with their preferences, or even that it was an unwanted, or even in 10% of cases, a coerced abortion. That is a very, and 60% of them said that if they had had more support from others or more financial support, they would have carried the baby to term. So think about that, 60%. We've lost 60 million, over 60 million children to abortion. About 40 million of those kids might still be alive now if their mothers had simply been given the support that they needed and wanted at that time. So providing that kind of support, being willing to maybe reconsider our adherence to a sort of strict libertarian version of conservative politics. I'm seeing a growth in sort of more left-leaning folks being willing to speak out against abortion. We have the Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising group that's operating across the country, Secular Pro-Life, Rehumanized International, these groups that have come along and brought a pro-life perspective that is coming from different political foundations than we're used to in the pro-life movement. It seems to me that over the years, we've tended to be, you know, rather knee-jerk conservatives, if I can say so. I tend to be fairly politically conservative myself, but I don't want to sacrifice children's lives to fiscal conservatism. You know, I don't want to sound like I'm advocating any and all social policies here. I mean, we know that, you know, in a country like Sweden, they have a very robust safety net. They also have a very, very high abortion rate. So it's a complicated story what actually brings down abortion rates. But in a country like the United States with a strong pro-life foundation still here, problems like healthcare, housing, flexible work hours, these things could make a real difference in saving babies from abortion. And I'm starting to see some willingness to think about those issues within the pro-life movement. So those are some of the things I think we're doing right. You know, we're holding ground. We're still here. We're ready to fight. We're in a moment of confusion, but in the midst of all that, we're starting to explore creatively some new ideas. And, I think we're very early in that process, but I'm glad to see that it's beginning to happen.
Do you remember where you were when you heard that Roe versus Wade had been overturned?
I was sitting right here in this desk. And I was, not planning to organize nationwide rallies celebrating the ruling that day. We had put together a plan for about 100 rallies around the country in city centers and at federal courthouses and so forth. And it was a Friday, so it was a really inconvenient day for all of that. I had other plans. And you know, I was really like, oh, please don't let it be today. so that was, I was sitting right here and the news came down and my immediate reaction was, oh crap, I got to get to work. I know I've heard a lot of stories about people just having ecstatic moments of celebration. It wasn't like that for me. The leaked draft that had come out a couple months before had given us all a lot of hope, but also a lot of worry. And I think it really robbed us of our joy that day, because instead of being just overwhelmed to find out that, in fact, you know, Samuel Alito had penned this incredible argument against Roe v. Wade, overturning it for all time, we were just kind of relieved that it wasn't something else, that they didn't back down, that the leak didn't have the effect of undermining the ruling ultimately. So it was a sense of relief and then a sense of having to get down to work. That same day, though, I had a couple of kind of dark experiences. A brother of mine, one of the three of us who was down there at Daley Plaza or the Civic Center in Chicago back in September 30th, 1972, he had a very good friend of his, he thought was a very good friend, text him and say, I can't have anything more to do with you. And you're just a horrible person because of your pro-life position. My brother had helped my father to write his memoir. So this friend of his, Jay, just cut him loose forever. You know, the following day, I had a friend of mine do the same thing, somebody that I did a comedy improv with. I was ultimately able to win that friend back. It took about a year and a half. But so I had mixed emotions because I saw the pain and confusion and worry in my pro-choice friends and family. I saw how upset and confused they were by that. And though, of course, I was celebrating this incredible court victory for us, I also was aware of this, of the suffering and confusion that it was causing for others, and, you know, and beginning to see the backlash that would ultimately, you know, lead to where we are now with some really difficult battles on our hands in terms of these state referenda all over the country.
Yes. Do you think your work has changed since Dobbs' decision dropped, especially now that we're 2 years out? There's been a little bit of time for everybody to wrap their minds around and kind of regroup, re-strategize. Has your work changed in any way?
Yeah, it has. I've become much, much, much more focused on organizing pro-life leaders. Last year, I co-founded a sort of association of an unincorporated association of pro-life leaders called Pro-Life Vanguard that is bringing people together to debate some of the tough questions we have, you know, about what's the role of the 14th Amendment, or, you know, how hard should we push on abortion bans versus assistance to mothers? What can we do to address the issue of fetal anomalies and threats to the life of the mother, which have become, you know, the main, like the point of the spear for the other side as they try to undermine our pro-life, you know, legislation. We see that in the Supreme Court hearing today, that they're trying to use a emergency medical treatment as a way of, you know, pushing abortion into every ER in the country. So that's really been my biggest focus, is organizing leaders more intentionally. Another big focus has been on these other issues, like I suggested, you know, paid parental leave, flexible work hours, prenatal child care, healthcare, housing. These are issues that lead and push women to get abortions. Last January, 2023, I published a joint statement for a post-Roe future, we're calling it, with a couple of other pro-life leaders at post-Roe future.com. At post-Roe future.com, you can see our call for the pro-life movement to, you know, not to be willing to just ban abortion, but to go farther to help mothers. And thankfully, that's happened. We've seen, you know, Medicaid expansion in, you know, Alaska, Mississippi, and other states. We've seen, you know, $100 million devoted to care for mothers in Texas. And typically pro-life restrictions carry with them, you know, significant funds to help women so that they don't feel like abortion's their only choice.
We've got about 3 minutes left. And I'm wondering, at this point in time in the history of the pro-life movement, what gives you hope? What helps you to keep going?
Well, I think, you know, aside from, you know, the sort of spiritual foundations that are mysterious and that I don't, you know, want to pretend to be able to describe the architecture of, Here, in the real world of relationships and politics and activities and all of that, I would say that it's the fact that we can still go out into the public square. You know, our focus of the Pro-Life Action League is in direct action. The fact that in all those blue states like Illinois and California and New York, where abortion has just been expanded, we have people outside abortion facilities praying, counseling, reaching out, offering help. We have great pro-life law firms that are defending our laws, defending our rights as pro-life activists. It's the activist spirit, and the fact that the people are willing to sacrifice, that the pro-life movement didn't just, you know, wash, you know, dust off its hands, say mission accomplished, and walk away that day that Roe v. Wade was overturned. People have recognized that there's a backlash we have to fight against. And that's really what gives me hope more than anything else, is the dedication of the regular rank and file pro-life folks who continue to write those checks, to continue to come out and hold those protest signs, and continue to offer those prayers up, you know, for those of us on the front lines, and to recruit their friends and neighbors to the cause.
Well, Eric, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on Positively Pro-Life. I credit your father with helping me to become pro-life and to join the pro-life movement. I was a secular journalist, and I read his book, 99 Ways to Close Abortion Centers or something like that.
I
was just amazed by what he had to say, and I had the opportunity to actually interview him as a secular reporter for a public radio network.
Awesome.
And that was amazing. And it's so good to see you carrying on his legacy. And I just want to thank you so much for all you do for pro-life.
Well, thank you for that. And it's an honor to carry on that legacy and to find new ways to innovate. And one of those ways is a little resource we call Sharing the Pro-Life Message. This is a little handbook that is now in its seventh edition. It's in a post-Roe version now, with answering so many of those questions that have arisen just in the last 2 years. And so I would encourage folks, if you want to have all the answers at your fingertips all the time, go to prolifeaction.org and go to our little shop and get a copy of that handbook. It's a really powerful resource. And literally the last thing I talked to my dad about before he passed away in January 2021.
Wow. Eric Scheidler, Executive Director of the Pro-Life Action League, thank you for joining us on Positively Pro-Life today.
It's been my honor. Thank you.
Positively Pro-Life is made possible through the generous support of the members of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation all across the Commonwealth. Thanks for joining us today, and remember, there's always a reason to choose life.